Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega. We begin with a question.
Who won the Civil War?
Now that's Courtney Plunk. Back in 2014, Plunk was a student at Texas Tech in Lubbock, Texas, playing the part of a roving reporter to discover what her fellow students knew about American history and politics.
Who won the Civil War?
Who won the Civil War?
We did? The South?
Like the one in 1965 or what Civil War?
Who won it?
Who was even in it?
Who was in it? Just tell me who was in it.
Ooh, I don't know.
Why you making me do this?
Who won the Civil War?
Oh my God. Hey, I'm drawing a blank. It's one of those things.
I feel like I'm on the Jimmy Kimmel Show.
America? I don't know.
That's the Confederates, right?
Dang it.
I have no clue.
The Union. The North.
Yes.
Okay,
right. Painful. But the video was an instant internet sensation. But as entertaining and, yes, horrifying as these kinds of person-on-the-street interviews or student-on-the-quad interviews can be, they can't reliably capture the full landscape of American civic knowledge. But unfortunately, in 2014, Texas Tech student responses were uncomfortably close to the dismal state of American political knowledge. The Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania has conducted the Civics Knowledge Survey since 2006. And typically, the results show just how little basic information Americans can recall about our nation and its political processes. In 2016, just prior to the election that put Donald Trump in the White House, only a quarter of Americans could name all three branches of government. And this was, quote, the poorest showing on that question in a half dozen years. And, quote, nearly a third of Americans cannot name any of the three branches of government. But take heart, dear listener, all is not lost. After bottoming out 5 years ago, something rather stunning happened. American civic knowledge improved, in fact, rather dramatically. In 2020, nearly three quarters of Americans correctly named freedom of speech as one of the rights guaranteed under the First Amendment. Also in 2020, more than half of those surveyed accurately named all three branches of the federal government, the largest percentage of Americans giving the right answer in the history of the survey. Everybody, so, just how did American civic knowledge improve so rapidly? There's no way to know for certain, but it is reasonable to think that more Americans could identify free speech as a First Amendment right in 2020 because media regularly discussed ideological tensions on college campuses as debates about free speech. Now, as for the much higher percentage of Americans who understood the three branches of government, well, it's worth noting that the impeachment of President Trump by the U.S. Congress dominated political news from late 2019 through the first third of 2020. Nothing like a little impeachment trial to tone up on that separation of powers clarity. So if high-profile public battles about free speech and presidential accountability led to a marked improvement in civic knowledge, what might be the outcome of the recent pitched battles in state legislatures about critical race theory curriculum? Listen to what some state legislators across the country had to say this spring.
A teacher may not teach that one race is inherently superior to another race.
There are those that believe that certain segments of our society cannot advance because of racism, that the system has to be modified or torn down.
You see it across the country. I mean, it is tearing communities apart. It's wrong. It should not be taught in schools.
I mean, how would anyone have a problem with this? It's amazing.
Okay, I see what y'all are trying to do here, but guys, shh. You might just manage to create a nation of novice critical race theorists. We're joined now by Dr. Prudence Carter, professor and outgoing dean of the Graduate School of Education at the University of California, Berkeley, where she focuses on race, class, gender, and education inequality. She's the author of Stubborn Roots, Race, Culture, and Inequality in the U.S. and South African Schools, and recently she became president-elect of the American Sociological Association. Professor Carter, it is so great to have you back on the show.
It's very nice to be here. Thank you.
Now, for the uninitiated or those who may think they're initiated but are not, can you tell us what is critical race theory?
Well, Melissa, to be honest with you, I didn't know what critical race theory was until I started working on my PhD and was in graduate school. It is a theoretical framework that was actually created and developed by legal scholars. It comes out of critical legal studies in the 1970s, 1980s. It developed and spread into other areas like education and other social sciences. And essentially what critical race theory does is try to show how race and racism can still be found, can still be promulgated in policies and politics and laws in our society. Even if they seem facially neutral, they can actually engender disparities among races so that those who have been historically minoritized and disadvantaged, like Black, Brown, and other people of color, can still be disadvantaged. It centers structural racism. It centers how white privilege and white supremacy manifest themselves even through our political, social, and economic institutions.
Now, I want to go to that point that you made about learning it in grad school. I think that's when I certainly used the language of CRT for the first time or, you know, was introduced to it in a classroom. Is anybody teaching critical race theory in like third grade?
Well, that's what's actually quite humorous and actually sad about this. I would love to know which elementary and middle schools are teaching critical race theory, and for that matter, high schools are teaching critical race theory. It suggests to me that what we might be talking about is a straw man in American education, both K-12 and higher education. Certainly, there are some undergraduate courses where there may be a reference to critical race theory, but it is something that many of us have learned in graduate school. And I wonder if this is really about the fear of teaching about race in a more critical and incisive way in American schooling.
I mean, indeed, it feels like it must be about that, right? I mean,
and
I guess part of what I've been wondering, and as I started this segment in our conversation, I'm wondering if it might actually have a backfiring effect. So again, our American civic knowledge is really like shamefully low. And yet when we see things that come into the news, like free speech or the separation of powers, then suddenly actually Americans are able to identify and apply those basic concepts more accurately. I'm wondering if that might also happen, not only with actual critical race theory, but simply with discussions of race, that in fact, conservative legislators might be doing the opposite of what they think they're doing.
Well, certainly if you look through history around the prohibition of various things in our society, what they do is cultivate interest in that which has been stigmatized or denied. And so you may actually have more people going to do the research to figure out really what is this big bad wolf that these legislators are talking about. And certainly if you look at Google searches, they have increased exponentially as people are trying to teach themselves about what critical race theory is. What is all of this controversy about? So it's possible that there could be more underground movements, or there could be actually more study groups, consciousness raising groups, as people try to work outside the bounds of not the narrow bounds of knowledge that these laws are producing.
My dad used to put the books that he most wanted us to read on a shelf that said, "Don't read these books." And of course, what would we do as soon as he was gone? We'd read those books.
That's right.
But I'm wondering how we might be able to fit this into a broader set of concerns that have been bipartisan and cross-ideological, about what it is Americans do need to know about our history and about how our political systems work.
Well, you know, it is the case that knowledge is socially constructed and it can be politically bounded. What this current state shows us is that politics and may infuse what students are learning. Political ideology shapes what we learn, and that has been the case throughout human history. What I find a bit difficult about these particular laws is that instead of saying, here's a framework that could be critiqued or problematized, and we can juxtapose that next to other understandings of history, and then to teach students critically how to discern or go between them, it's just being thrown out as you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And so it is a narrowing of history in critical ways. One of my main concerns is, particularly since we've just celebrated Juneteenth on Saturday, is how educators are supposed to actually teach and celebrate a federal holiday, but they can't talk about its historical origins in the most penetrating ways. So there are some contradictions here, Melissa. There is also little guidance for educators about what they can and cannot talk about because the definitions of critical race theory are now so vague in these state laws.
I guess even hearing you say that sentence, educators being told what they can and cannot talk about, just seems so, and perhaps this is the privilege of the academy itself, but it seems so surprising to me as a way to think about how we would want any set of topics addressed within American public education. Isn't it sort of the, I don't know, curricular ideal to have this free exchange of ideas?
In our nation, historically, we've said we are a country of freedom of expression. We are a country where we are trying to produce the most critical thinkers and promoting individualism, having a tolerance for a variety of ideas. But what these laws do is actually contradict and countervail those very principles. So it is a case that we have some academic freedom being in many ways suppressed by these new laws in these various states. I would not be surprised if we see a number of lawsuits ensue, particularly because some of these lawsuits are reaching into higher education. It is the case in public and K-12 education that states have more jurisdiction and can govern the standards of curriculum. But in higher education, there is a lot more academic freedom, particularly for scholars and researchers and professors. So there is a narrowing and a tailoring here. It is antithetical, in my opinion, to the various principles and tenets of freedom of expression, freedom of thought that we espouse to believe in this country.
Professor Carter, let me step back a little bit to exactly this point about the politics of curriculum. Mm-hmm. If we look back in sort of American history, maybe back to the 1920s when we're first beginning to have a generalized public school system, what was its goal? What were we hoping to do with public school?
So, to be clear, I am not a historian of education, but from what I know from teaching and bringing together history in various forms, let's be real about the massification of education and its relationship to the development of the American economy. And a large part of this was the realization of many employers and large corporate owners about the need for literacy and numeracy skills to have better informed, better educated workers. And so the opening up of schools was really driven in a large part by the needs and the demands of the economy. And that did spread. It spread in a separate and not even an equal way. Then you had the massive migration and immigration of various Southern and Eastern European groups, as well as migrants, the great migration of those who were the descendants and those who were formerly enslaved to the Northern and Rust Belt cities. So a large part of this was about understanding that there needed to be some education, as particularly as we moved into the periods in the eras of the wars and needed an educated populace.
So building on that, I'm thinking about the world we now live in, which for American workers is much less likely to be a world of manufacturing, much more likely to be a world of ideas. And in fact, to the extent that we think of it as an entire world, a quite diverse world of ideas.
That's right.
Wouldn't this suggest that some versions of even the kind of mischaracterized critical race theory, but understanding race and its role in our history would be valuable for the workforce that we're now creating?
Where there are a couple of points here, Melissa. Another part of the massification of education was also to socialize. Education is a socializing institution to make sure that you could create citizens and patriots because you had these immigrants, people coming from different parts of the world, and that they could all cohere around certain fundamental tenets. You move to this kind of the more contemporary period, we have increasingly become more diverse, a more open society, and part of the push in the 1960s and the 70s and 80s was about a deeper inclusion and a widening of an expansion of knowledge because our society has become so much more diverse. But the problem is social psychologists are showing, and I'm thinking the work of Jennifer Richardson and Maureen Craig, they're showing that the more diverse we become, the less tolerant particularly whites become in their attitudes about the inclusion of these groups. Meanwhile, part of having this openness, a multicultural movement, is also about trying to maintain the legitimacy of the American Republic, of the United States of America, as a place of freedom and justice and liberation. So it's really hard to see how we can maintain that identity or even grow it if we're going to have a narrow construction of what it means to be a nation.
Indeed, I think of Baldwin saying that we can understand his love for the nation, his patriotism, in his willingness to critique the nation. That is actually the evidence of the love, the commitment to the national notions, our kind of aspirational best ideas of who we can be. It actually requires that we critique that we are not yet that.
That's exactly right. And another part of it is, just let's just be honest about it, is that all of human history is about some form of subjugation. So there is that logic that's embedded in these laws, which we don't want individuals or groups to feel badly. I can't imagine any aspect of human history that hasn't been about some form of subjugation, from imperialism to colonialism, settler colonialism, colonization, wars, religious conflict. Everything has been, sociologically speaking, about groups subjugating, subordinating, marginalizing, oppressing others. If you use this logic that's currently at play now, it means in theory that you couldn't teach any history, if you think about it. The logic is flawed. And it's also a second point is it erases. We spent a large part of time trying to educate, if you want an educated populace, presumably as we gather more knowledge and discover more things, you share it with the people. Why would you actually legalize or sanction not telling the truth?
Is it a version of book burning?
It is. In some ways, it's a modern day form of it. But it's not unlike, though, the struggles, the curricular and political debates around creationism, right, and evolution. This is how we know education as a social institution is a political institution. It is a social institution. It's constructed. And these lawmakers are trying to create the bounds of knowledge today, very narrowly. Mm-hmm.
Indeed, in some ways, the attack is the thing that lets you know it's worth the fight.
Exactly.
Very swiftly, what do you think classrooms will look like in September, in the fall, as compared to what they do right now in these states that have passed these laws?
Well, I'm very concerned, particularly about the lack of guidance for educators, particularly teachers in social studies and civics classes, because as I mentioned earlier, the laws are vague. I've spent a lot of time trying to understand exactly how they define CRT, and there is no definition, really. There are just these different kind of vague and broad swipes about what things are going to do. So it's the question of whether or not teachers can actually talk about race. They can talk about white privilege and white supremacy. Can they talk about slavery and the brutality of the peculiar institution? These are the questions.
Prudence Carter is a professor and outgoing dean of the Graduate School of Education at the University of California, Berkeley. Next month, she'll be a professor of sociology at Brown University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, everybody. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. And we're continuing our conversation on critical race theory. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, set off a firestorm last month when he said this.
On the issue of critical race theory, et cetera, I'll obviously have to get much smarter on whatever the theory is. But I do think it's important, actually, for those of us in uniform to be open-minded and be widely read. And the United States Military Academy is a university. And it is important that we train and we understand. And I want to understand white rage, and I'm white.
Now, the reaction to his comments have been, let's just say, out of proportion, and also more than a little rude.
He's not just a pig, he's stupid.
Like so many other aspects of this recent, somewhat disingenuous debate over critical race theory, the general's comments ended up revealing more about his critics than they exposed about himself. Following the general's remarks, J.D. Vance, the author and social media firestarter, tweeted, "What I find so enraging about the Joint Chiefs pandering on progressive wokeness is that they know damn well the geography and politics of who dies in American wars. The conservative Americans you trash are disproportionately bleeding for this country." Unquote. Now, I'm not sure if Vance knows that African Americans make up 19% of the active duty enlisted, which means black folk are disproportionately fighting and bleeding for the country. But bad statistics aside, General Milley's comments and the criticism that those comments evoked raise important questions about who can lay claim to serving and sacrificing for the nation. And here to explore that with me is Scott Ferris, author of Freedom on Trial, the first post-Civil War battle over civil rights and voter suppression. Great to talk with you again, Scott.
Hello, Melissa. It's always a pleasure.
It feels to me like January 6th revealed some serious problems with former military and police officers being radicalized. Couldn't an exploration being widely read of issues of race help to address that?
Oh, I would agree 100% with that, Melissa. I mean, obviously, we know that groups like the Proud Boys, Patriot Prayer, Oath Keepers, et cetera, have made no secret of the fact that they're encouraging their members to join the military as well as local police forces. I guess they have some sort of fantasy about someday being in a position of authority if they ever have to take over the United States government or something like that. So I think it's a problem that General Milley was certainly wise to raise. I hope it's not very extensive. In fact, we don't have good data to know how extensive neo-Confederate and white supremacist views are in the military, but it's certainly a concern. And the military, being one of the most integrated institutions in American society, you mentioned that 19% of all the active duty are African-Americans and 40% are people of color. Obviously, you want to have an organization of that size be harmonious, and so you need people to understand each other, understand their backgrounds, understand their special experiences. And so I think, as you said, General Milley's offering the fairly commonsensical notion that, hey, I should learn about all the people under my commands and understand how they think so that they can all work better together.
Now, J.D. Vance is an author of Hillbilly Elegy and thinks about working class folks. And it does seem to me that there's a working class overrepresentation in the military. Is that right?
Well, I'm sure there's some degree there's some truth to that in the sense that it's an all-volunteer army. So it is self-selected. And I think a lot of people who don't have obvious pathways to success in business and other things see the military as a great career or in a way to raise money for college. And so I do believe that people from the working classes probably are disproportionately represented, but I don't think it's on a racial basis. It's more on a class basis.
Is this attack on so-called critical race theory, which is really kind of a straw man here, but feels like it's an attack on sort of engaging in intellectual, academic, scholarly debates around race, is this consistent with how sort of conservative white discourse has operated over the decades, or is this a departure? Is this something new?
No, this is very much in the American tradition, sadly. I think that one of the things, we've talked about this before, Melissa, I think, you know, that this is all about a struggle for political power. It's a very cynical ploy used by some to divide America by race for their own purposes. And so we see that, for example, in the populist movement of the late 19th century. And it's not a coincidence, I don't think, that the rise of populism coincided with the implementation of Jim Crow. People were very anxious that whites and blacks, poor farmers and others, didn't align themselves in a new political coalition to try to upset the status quo, because those who benefit from the status quo like to maintain it. So we've seen this with that. And then, of course, we also went through McCarthyism, where, you know, people were forbidden to teach Marxism and socialism in schools. And there was, you know, all sorts of distrust. But again, that was not why, just as with critical race theory, it's not widely taught in American universities, let alone kindergartens. Marxism and socialism was not particularly widely taught in American colleges in the 1940s and 50s. But it was a good bugaboo to, again, sort of try to define your party, try to paint the other side as not as American as you are. And so I think you're right. This is a CRT is a straw man. But unfortunately, we set up a lot of straw men in American history.
I'm wondering, though, if it's a miscalculation. I'm thinking about your own writing and the ways that somehow knowing some of the horrors of American race, of white supremacy, actually reconnects me to my experience as an American. It gives me a sense of optimism, of movement forward, and of the possibility of change.
Well, absolutely. And as you know, that's one reason I wrote the book Freedom on Trial, was that I did want to explore my own family's history in a very important part of racial conciliation in American history, Reconstruction. Learned that my great-grandfather was a member of the Ku Klux Klan and was indicted for assaulting some black men to prevent them from voting. And yes, that you know, it did not make me love America less. It made me love it more, because you start to see the struggle that people of color and others have had over the years, women included, to try to achieve their place in society and want to see the Declaration, the Constitution, live up to the ideals that were stated so eloquently 200 plus years ago. So I think a very truthful, honest look at American history doesn't diminish your love of country. If anything, I think it expands it. It certainly did in my case.
Yeah, I would agree. Is there one thing that you would want folks to read other than Freedom on Trial if they were beginning to do some of this work for themselves?
Absolutely. One reason I wrote the book is I hoped that it would inspire people. That, as I mentioned in the book, you know, when we have ancestors that did great deeds, we put their portrait above the mantelpiece and we brag about it. We belong to the, you know, daughters of the American Revolution and the sons of the Confederate veterans and all these things. But, you know, when our ancestors also do something wrong, I think that we need to understand that. And I don't say it means we inherit their guilt, but it does mean that they bequeath us with obligations to help solve the problems that still linger. But I think it's very important for all of us to take a look not only at our American history, but our family history, because often they're one and the same.
Scott Ferris is the author of Freedom on Trial, the first post-Civil War battle over civil rights and voter suppression. Thank you for joining me, Scott.
Thank you, Melissa.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Back in April, the recipe site Epicurious announced that they would no longer be publishing new recipes that use beef. They cited beef's environmental impact and the greenhouse gas emissions associated with raising livestock in their reasoning. Now, not long after the Epicurious announcement, 11 Madison Park, a New York-based Michelin-starred restaurant, announced they would stop serving animal products, pointing to sustainability. The announcements were met with mixed reactions and reignited conversations about the role and responsibilities of individual consumers for battling climate change. In the U.S., where meat is often the centerpiece of our meals, and where, according to the USDA, the average American eats 222 pounds of poultry and red meat a year as of 2018, reducing or removing meat from our diets can feel like a big hurdle. Joining me now is Alicia Kennedy, a food writer and author of the newsletter From the Desk of Alicia Kennedy. Alicia, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
Talk to me about how significant the decision was for Epicurious to decide to no longer publish beef recipes.
It is a hugely significant decision in the food media landscape, where meat is still really, really prominent, you know, as well as shrimp, as well as fish. You know, there's no kind of move in the broad food media toward saying, hey, that there is a problem with the amount of meat and animal products that we consume in the United States. There's very much a sense that we have to say that it's okay to eat as much beef or as much chicken as you want. We have to say that it's okay to, you know, get these products anywhere, you know, not go to your local butcher, not make sure the rancher is using sustainable practices. You know, it's very much a hedonistic type of approach to eating and consuming meat especially. And so when Epicurious made this decision, they really broke with the food media kind of unspoken rule that you don't tell people that anything is bad about something that we eat.
So let's talk a little bit about what are the problems around meat consumption. And then this more collective question of why it might not be good for us as a species, as a planet. So can you maybe say a little bit about both?
Sure. Well, the food system globally accounts for 1/3 of greenhouse gas emissions. And so that encompasses lots of different things. That's not just meat, but beef specifically accounts for 14.5% of that. And so a lot of that is maybe not specifically the practices of beef or that sort of thing, but in total, how the way we produce, the way we process, the way we transfer and transport beef accounts for 14.5%. And so that's a big chunk of those emissions. And it's also, yes, this place where we can make a personal choice to reduce or give up consumption of this product totally because of its impact. And personal choice, of course, is a tricky subject because we want to talk about, you know, really getting at those corporations who are responsible for, you know, massive amounts of greenhouse gas emissions. We don't want to say it's all of our personal problem that has caused global warming. But at the same time, we can make these smaller choices in our day-to-day lives that make a difference and recognize, you know, the big impact of what we eat on climate change. And also, you know, if we were going to kind of change the way we produce and process beef, if we were going to stop subsidizing industrial meat and dairy and the factory farms, we would have to change how we consume. We would have to probably lower that amount of meat we're eating every year from 222 pounds, you know, going to have to drastically reduce that. And that would be kind of a natural progression if we did change regulations. So it's a very tricky subject because it is about all of us, but it's also about how we all respond to, you know, this knowledge. And also the fact that the government does subsidize those industrial beef and dairy for $38 billion a year. And so it's not it's not all about our personal decisions. It is about the regulations and it is about the government. You know, that money is making the cost of meat artificially low in the supermarkets. It's not accounting for the workers who are often, you know, not paid properly, they haven't been attended to properly during the COVID-19 pandemic. I believe 59,000 meat processing workers came down with COVID-19. And it's these places where they are situated, these factory farms, they're going to have runoff that is going to have environmentally detrimental impacts on people who live in those areas. So it's a really big issue, but at the same time, one of the only ways we have to combat it is to say, I'm not going to eat meat that where if I don't know where it's coming from.
Let's talk about our actual plate. So for so many Americans who are brought up with a particular, you know, the meat is the biggest part, and then there's a little starch and maybe a little starchy vegetable right next to it. Yeah. What does a plate look like that isn't that?
I stopped eating meat 10 years ago. And so I don't remember even what it was like a little to center my plate around meat. But, you know, it's centering beans, legumes, where there's so much variety, so much diversity in those, that kind of a family of proteins. You know, we have tofu, we have tempeh, we have seitan. There's just so much abundance in mushrooms as well for creating meaty dishes. There are proteins that are plant-based. It does take a little more work though to get them to the plate. You know, you can throw a steak in a cast iron pan with a little salt and that will be delicious. But when you're talking about beans, it does mean you need to like get a little more creative. You have to use citrus and herbs and you know, figure out how you're going to make those delicious. But in the end, it's worth it. It's better for our health to at least cut back a little bit on meat and replace that with legumes. And so I think that it's just about kind of finding that groove with replacing proteins that are animal based, you know, just a few times a week and figuring out that you can eat really deliciously without it. That's why I think Meatless Monday is something important. And those days where you don't eat meat are important because they're how you kind of figure out that, hey, I'm not starving and I'm not, you know, miserable and grouchy just because I ate beans instead of chicken. You know, I think that's a really important thing to learn.
Thank you so much, Alicia Kennedy, food writer and author of the newsletter From the Desk of Alicia Kennedy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Around this time every year, we see list after list of the buzziest books about to hit the shelves, from beach reads to engrossing nonfiction. There will be no shortage of options at your local library or neighborhood bookstores this summer. And it turns out a lot of you are already turning to books to beat the heat.
Hi, this is Deanna from Massapequa Park. A great summer reading might be The Third Pole by Mark Sinnott, reading about climbing Mount Everest and the history of adventures to Mount Everest really made me feel very cool while I was sitting in the sun finishing that excellent novel. Thank you so much.
Hi, my name is Denise McQuinn. I'm calling from Dallas, Texas. Anything by Tom Robbins. He's a great writer and he makes you laugh out loud. Carl Hyson, I love his writing style and humor too.
Hi, my name is Amy and I'm calling from Ferndale, Washington. Right now, I'm reading Butter, Honey, Pig Bread by Francesca Ekwuyati. It's about Nigerian twin sisters who are coming together in their mother's house in Lagos after spending years apart in different parts of the Anglo world. The theme of how family breaks apart and comes back together feels very relevant to me.
As always, our listeners have lots of great recommendations, but I know I like to have a big stack of books ready for the summer. So we've got you covered if you're like that. Back with us is Constance Grady, culture writer at Vox. So Constance, you were saying that, you know, obviously the industry is interested in being able to actually sell text, right? Sell books. And these books, right? The kinds of things that we all sit by the pool with or at the beach, or maybe even just like try to sneak and read in the car while you're dropping your kid off at camp. This is where, you know, some of that real reading time happens. So what are some of your specific recommendations for good summer books?
Yeah, well, one book that I'm really excited for that I think fits into what we were talking about in the previous segment really well is The Other Black Girl. This is a debut novel by Zakiya Delilah Harris. It was a really, really fought over, anticipated book. It sold at auction for, I think, seven figures. And it is about a young woman, a Black girl, who is an editorial assistant at a big publishing house. And then one day they hire another Black girl so that there are finally two of them. And at first our heroine sort of thinks, oh, this will be great. We'll be able to have solidarity. I'll finally have someone I can talk to in the office. But then things slowly become more and more sinister. It's a really fun read, but it's also really interested in these questions that publishing as an industry is facing right now about this sort of industry that thinks of itself as being really liberal and progressive, but is still mostly made up of white people, and why that is, what the structural issues are that lead to these problems, and how it affects the books that they put out into the world.
I have absolutely been anticipating that book. I cannot wait to read it. I've carved out time for this summer. You know, I'm also kind of interested in thinking about how artists, how novelists are writing about the pandemic. And I'm wondering if we have books that are coming out in this summer or that maybe are already on our shelves that help us to maybe reflect on what we've all just been living through.
Yeah, there are a couple of the first wave of nonfiction books about the pandemic have come out. I just finished reading The Premonition by Michael Lewis. He's a Vanity Fair journalist. He also is the author of Moneyball. This is a really interesting book because it's mostly about the figures who did see the pandemic coming and were able to predict it pretty accurately and figure out what, as it turned out, really effective public health measures would have been for it. And then kind of infuriatingly, it's about the ways that they were all sidelined from decision-making and we ended up in the crisis state we found ourselves in. It's incredibly infuriating to read, but there's also something sort of calming about seeing these experts figure out what's happening and sort of place order over this year of chaos. Another one that's also sort of in a similar vein is The Plague Year by Lawrence Wright. He writes for The New Yorker. He's won a Pulitzer for his nonfiction previously. And that one's just sort of kind of going through the all of the wild events of 2020, not only COVID, but also everything that happened with the election and with Trump and with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And it's very, very, what's interesting about Wright is that he has a lot of access to major political figures. So he's able to bring in quotes from all of these players who are actually involved with everything. And you kind of find yourself in the cockpit of this year of chaos and can sort of see how everything went so terribly wrong. So we're getting two different perspectives on all of the horrors of last year. And it's really, really enraging to read, but also pretty clarifying.
Now, we're moving into June next week, which is Pride Month, and Tori Peters has a text, Detransition Baby, and it's gotten a lot of praise for how it sort of addresses trans experiences. Tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, so Detransition Baby deals with two trans women who are exes, and one of them is in the process of actually detransitioning. So she was living as a trans woman for a while, and now she's decided that she's happier going back to life as a man. It's a really interesting novel because the idea of people who detransition has kind of been used as a political cudgel a lot. You know, this sense that, you know, not everyone's really committed to transitioning, so we should somehow make it harder for them to do it in ways that are really not helpful and really not nuanced. But this book is able to make that experience really personal and really embedded in the trans experience. I read it and I thought the writing was so playful and lovely, but I wasn't sure I was really qualified to say how it handled trans issues authentically. But Emily Vanderwerf, my colleague at Vox, who's our critic at large and is a trans woman and writes really beautifully about trans issues, she said that she read it and it was like someone had reached inside of her and pulled out all of her deepest, darkest feelings about being trans and then just showed them to the world so everyone could see her guts and stuff.
Oh, well, that is both a fantastic and also exactly what you want a book to do, to be kind of disruptive and discomforting in that way. We're going to be signing off, but I do have to say I love that the June pick for the Vox Book Club is Rahman Alam's Leave the World Behind. I read that sucker in one night. I love that book. I cannot suggest it enough for folks.
It's so fun. It's just a great vacation book because it's the world's worst vacation, so yours will feel much, much more fun.
It really is true. Constance Grady is a culture writer at Vox. Constance, thank you for being here and for all your recommendations.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hi, this is Vicky. I'm calling from Pahoa, Hawaii. Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is a great summer read.
Hi, this is Kathy Licht in San Rafael, California. I'm currently reading The Nest. It's a good summer read, it has great characters, and just a nice, light read.
And that's the show for today, y'all. I really enjoy being here with you and appreciate you tuning in. Now, if you missed anything, or you just want to listen back again, check out our podcast. You can find it wherever you listen to your podcast, or head over to thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for spending part of your day with us. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.